Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Kristen Espeland has a report on growth in the Fort Knox area. First, Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson has been in meetings with city department leaders looking for ways to cut $20 million out of the metro government budget. The mayor has put a freeze on hiring and travel, but says cuts to employment and services may be coming soon. Gabe Bullard has more on the mayor's options.
The trouble began with what turned out to be an overly optimistic revenue prediction. The mayor anticipated 2.9% growth. It was the smallest projected growth since the 2003 merger. But income fell short in the first quarter, markets tanked in October, and now the city is scrambling to cut costs. Mayor spokesperson Chris Pointer.
The biggest expense for metro government, like any agency or any business, is personnel.
Pointer says Abramson has been meeting with his staff to determine which departments can handle cuts, and he plans to announce those cuts after Thanksgiving. He won't be alone.
Columbus, Ohio was looking at an $80 to $90 million shortfall. Charlotte has a $40 million shortfall. Cincinnati's just reporting a $15 million shortfall recently.
Chris Haney is a research manager for the National League of Cities. He says struggling cities have three options: raise taxes and fees, dig into financial reserves, or make service cuts.
The expenditure cuts that we're starting to see aren't over with yet. And at some point, if the problem is deep enough, there are going to have to be revenue-raising options pursued, even if those are fairly politically difficult choices right now.
With job cuts announced recently at Yum! Brands and a 5-week shutdown coming soon at Louisville's Ford plants, the city is facing an additional drop in occupational tax revenue. The tax makes up 57% of Louisville's budget, so Haney says something will have to be done to raise revenues for the next fiscal year.
You may see, more fee for services, trying to move more services away from taxes and over to a sort of pay-as-you-go basis.
Every bit of research that I've done, everything that I've ever read, says that the last time in the world that you want to raise taxes is during a recession.
Metro Councilman Kevin Kramer says he speaks for the 11 council Republicans when he says no to raising taxes or cutting public safety services.
There are other branches of government that we could talk about finding ways to reduce expenditures without starting to talk about police and fire and EMS.
Like what?
Well, none of us wants to see, parks, but, parks isn't as essential as police.
But Chris Haney with the National League of Cities says there may be a quicker fix.
Most of the inside baseball here in Washington, D.C. says, that something happens with stimulus this week and or in early January.
That stimulus is a pot of money the government could give to cities for infrastructure improvements. Louisville has such projects planned, and Mayor spokesperson Chris Pointer says the stimulus package would free city dollars to be used on other expenses. But even if that does happen, Haney says it may not be strong enough to delay the inevitable.
The revenue shortfalls that we're talking about now are the result of, changes in the economy that happened anywhere from, 3 months to a year and a half ago. So we know that, with whatever happens to the economy in the next 6 to 9 months before we hit bottom, that's probably going to be playing out for the next, year and a half to 3 years.
For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
Since this report was produced, the mayor announced that metro government will shut down for 3 selected days to save money. The Fort Knox region of Kentucky is bracing for one of the biggest population booms in its history. Kristen Espeland investigates how so much growth so fast could help or hurt the region.
We're heading north and we're on the eastern boundary of the city limits of Elizabethtown because I wanted to show you another condominium development up here. So.
Elizabethtown planner Ed Pope drives into one of many subdivisions underway in this community just 45 miles south of Louisville.
2007 was the highest dollar volume construction year we had. We For a city our size, we were over $70 million in construction.
Pope says that's because nearby Fort Knox is about to swell with newcomers. It's part of the U.S. Army's Base Realignment and Closure Project, or BRAC, as the locals call it here. And Elizabethtown, the region's shopping center and Fort Knox neighbor, could be the popular choice for the thousands of military and civilians who choose to relocate. The influx is expected to be so great that the Department of Defense has set up a new organization called One Knox to help the communities prepare for growth. The organization's website reads like a travel brochure for the area, but also lists updates about BRAC activities at the base. One Knox head, Brad Richardson, says the anticipated 14,000 new arrivals may not sound like much.
But if you compare it on a percentage basis with Jefferson County, it would mean that you would be getting between 100 and 120,000 new people in the next 2.5 years.
Richardson says the region needs a huge chunk of state money to absorb that impact.
Luckily, even in a deficit budget situation, we got $100 million appropriated. $50 million for transportation, $50 million for infrastructure development, which will probably include education.
That means new and expanded schools for the anticipated thousands of children moving in. It's not yet certain exactly how many people will decide to relocate, but Water District Manager James Jeffries says they know for sure that drinking water resources will be squeezed. He says they can only pull so much from the Nolan River, and they've had to look northward for help.
We've chosen Louisville Water as that source. They have excess capacity. They're growing to the south, so that looks like it is the logical source.
Jeffrey says that while he's confident they've got a handle on meeting drinking water needs, the county isn't so prepared when it comes to handling sewage. Septic tanks are the treatment method of choice outside city boundaries. And Jeffrey says the lines between a home and its tank can sometimes rupture. And if that happens, groundwater and ultimately drinking water could be harmed.
The county will see the need to get into the sewer collection business as part of the continued development of the county. We can't continue, I think, to have 1 acre lots with 0.2 acres taken up in lateral lines time and time and time again. I think we'll have to be smarter than that.
There could be other threats to water quality with so many more paved surfaces, which increase stormwater runoff into rivers and streams. But Elizabethtown residents are more excited than concerned about so much growth. Joni and Johnny Malone run a local real estate company. They were among several sponsors of a weekend tour for military members thinking of relocating. They're hoping that eventually Elizabethtown will charm some of the visitors into buying one of their homes for sale. But Johnny Malone says the economic boost these newcomers bring won't be limited to real estate. Their salaries will pump money into local businesses. Their children will bring new resources for schools.
So this is a very big deal for this community. The impact will be felt throughout the region.
If that impact will be felt in a bustling economy, it will also be felt on busier roads, on once wooded lands converted to condos, and on the Dixie Highway, where the growing string of shopping malls connects Radcliffe and Elizabethtown. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Christian schools were once the fastest growing segment of private education. Now enrollment in Christian schools is flat or declining. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
Christian Academy of Indiana has a sprawling 60-acre campus in New Albany. New buildings, smooth parking lots, and lush landscaping.
It certainly creates competition.
Dennis Brooks is superintendent of the local public school system, New Albany-Floyd County Consolidated Schools.
It certainly makes me aware each day that parents have choices.
Brooks says the Protestant school's growth has not gone unnoticed. The school formed when two large churches decided that their burgeoning schools could be better managed as part of Christian Academy of Louisville. But the growth of Christian schools has now turned, and stories swirl about declining enrollment from Christian school administrators. Sarah Hauselman is the principal of Rock Creek Christian Academy in Sellersburg. During the 1990s, the enrollment increased by 30%. Now she says it's falling.
Most people are saying the same thing. It's the economy. They're not losing their kids to other private schools or Christian schools. They're losing their kids to public school because their parents can't afford to pay the tuition.
Of course, the poor economy is to blame, but so are the mounting expenses of running a school, everything from teacher salaries to outfitting classrooms and libraries with computers. Ken Smitherman is the president of the Association of Christian Schools International, which has more than 5,000 Protestant Christian member schools. He remembers when the upward trend ended.
We began noticing about 5 years ago that our number of schools was flattening off, and if anything, beginning to decrease.
And that translates into the loss of needed tuition dollars. Here's Ken Smitherman again.
Our schools are driven by tuitions and fees that are paid by individuals. You know, the whole government funding thing just simply does not occur in this country except on some very minutely limited aspects.
Talk of supporting religious schools with public money was in the limelight after President George W. Bush was first elected. Then Christian school administrators advocated the idea of vouchers, where parents can designate the public expenditure for their children's education to go to a chosen school. Columbia University's Teachers College professor Pearl Kane studies private schools. She says the economy could spur action.
The financial constraints that families are facing might give rise to renewal of activism for vouchers for religious schools.
Some experts say government support of a voucher system with religious school participation is a lost cause. Peter Cookson wrote School Choice, The Struggle for the Soul of American Education.
I think the issue of taking public dollars and supporting religious schools is extremely volatile. I'm sure there will be and continue to be a lot of lawsuits around that. And I don't, frankly, think there's a huge future for religious schools in that.
In recent years, publicly funded voucher programs in Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Florida have been embroiled in lawsuits. Notre Dame education expert David Sinkink says the current economy may force schools to experiment.
The economic downturn is going to put so much pressure on a number of the conservative Protestant schools that they'll be more open to accepting some kind of assistance from the government, especially if it's indirect through parents.
That could take the form of a tax credit for parents who send their kids to private schools. But Sinkink also says the situation could encourage Christian schools to reduce the role of religion in their programs. Rock Creek Christian Academy is exploring charter school status with the state of Indiana. It would bring public funding to the school, but require it to drop its religious curriculum. Sinkink and other experts agree the economic crisis doesn't mean the disappearance of Christian schools, but declining enrollments could mean they have less influence in education policy. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
In Frankfort, concerns are being raised about a monument park under development on the grounds of the historic Kentucky State Capitol. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has the story.
Kentucky's limestone and granite state capitol nestles in a park-like setting designed by the Olmsted brothers, sons of America's first landscape architect, the renowned Frederick Law Olmsted. Since the building's dedication in 1910, the grassy, tree-shaded northwest quadrant of the 33-acre campus has remained virtually untouched. But 2 years ago, Governor Ernie Fletcher's administration decided the space should be used for a monument park. David Buchta was director of state historic properties back then, and still is.
There became an interest in having a tourism enhancement package, and part of that was to develop that park, as well as a visitor center over here, which is underway.
In the last 2 years, the monument park has begun to take shape. Water lines are in. It's landscaped with trees, shrubs, and boulders. There's a walking trail, a water fountain, and two brick patios supporting large concrete benches embossed with the state seal. Several low-profile monuments dot the area, including one honoring Kentucky POW MIAs. For the most part, the project is proceeding as planned. But development of the previously undisturbed lawn has caught the eye of preservationists, like Ashley Averill of the Garden Club of Frankfort.
I prefer the green space that sets our beautiful Capitol and Executive Mansion apart from the rest of the city.
Averill says the Garden Club isn't opposed to monument parks. It just questions the wisdom of putting one on the historic Capitol grounds where space is at a premium. But that hasn't stopped the state from soliciting nonprofit organizations to erect even more monuments in the park. The first to win approval is the Kentucky Organ Donor Affiliates, or CODA. The group is constructing a 7-foot-tall, $20,000 granite monolith, says CODA's Jenny Jones.
We were interested in honoring individuals throughout the state who had given the gift of life through organ donation.
The criteria for monuments on the state capitol grounds says they, quote, should be of historical significance to the Commonwealth of Kentucky. But Jones says that's not the sole criteria.
It can be based on a group's or an individual's contribution of several instances, one being civic or social.
But the disruption of historic green space on the Capitol lawn has also caught the eye of Stephen Collins, son of former Governor Martha Lane Collins. He chairs the Historic Properties Advisory Council, which signed off on the park and the CODA monument prior to his tenure. He says the council may need to revisit the park project.
As we see more and more people wanting to honor their organization or groups that make significant contributions to the Commonwealth, we may have to look at how it would be able to be expanded without diminishing a very historical resource in the beauty of our Capitol grounds.
That's good news to the Garden Club's Ashley Averill, who wants to see the lawn preserved.
That's what makes it unique from so many other states' capitals. It's set on grounds, it's not hemmed in by office buildings, and it's beautiful, and we should be very cognizant of the green space that we do have.
But for now, the project moves forward. There have been some weather delays, and the state budget crunch put plans for a gazebo on the back burner, but work on the granite foundation for the CODA monument is underway. If you'd like to draw your own conclusions about the park, look for it on your right as you enter the drive that encircles the state capitol. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
When we come back, Stephanie Sanders talks with a U of L professor about problems that stem from taking too many medications. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Coming up, I'll speak with Sister Susan Gatz about the recent merger of the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth and another Catholic religious order in Pittsburgh. First, as the American healthcare system is flooded with more and more medications, an increasing number of patients are finding themselves on dozens of prescriptions. It's especially true of the elderly population. But without proper supervision, those medications can interfere with each other and cause even more health problems for the patient, decreasing quality of life. Stephanie Sanders talked about the problem called polypharmacy with Demetra Antimisieris. She's a Ph.D. in pharmacology as well as an assistant professor in the Department of Family and Geriatric Medicine at the University of Louisville.
Explain a little bit about what polypharmacy is.
Okay, the academic definition of polypharmacy, poly meaning many, pharma meaning drugs. The definition in the literature is the concurrent use of 5 drugs at the same time. But the real definition, if you ask me, is the use of any unnecessary drugs. So you could be taking 2 drugs or 1 drug, but if it's not indicated, if you don't really, really need it, then I think it's considered polypharmacy.
This is a particular problem for our elderly population. Can you explain a little bit more about why that is?
Yeah, yes. years ago, about 20 years ago, I did a pharmacy residency in geriatrics. And we've known in geriatrics for a very long time that medications should be taken very seriously. And when there is some sort of a change or symptom or problem in the elderly, clearly one has to look at the medications first. And that's because the elderly live with multiple chronic diseases and they're more frail. And this is sort of a new phenomenon because if you think about it, up until the 1940s, the care that we offered to patients was palliative. In other words, we couldn't allow people to live longer with multiple diseases. The modern medical technology has allowed us to help people live very long time with multiple chronic diseases, but that means using a lot of medications. So that's why it's more prevalent in the elderly. But recently, the public, even at younger ages, has been utilizing drugs more and more, almost as if they were elderly. A lot of young people live with chronic disease today, whereas 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. We all know about the teens that are becoming diabetic. So I have seen people who are 35 years old, homebound with multiple diseases, and they have to take multiple medications.
What types of problems does taking maybe too many medications, what does that pose for the patient?
Well, consider how difficult it is. Anybody who's ever had to take a course of antibiotics or have to remember to take an aspirin a day, it's very difficult just to remember. I've noticed that a lot of patients have a hard time knowing the difference between different brand names of the drugs and generic names. Also, the other problems include affording the drugs. And then what happens is something we call the prescribing cascade. Let's say you're given one drug and then you get a side effect from that drug. For example, an upset stomach. That upset stomach may be misconceived as being gastric ulcer disease or GERD. So then you get prescribed another drug to help treat that, which induces another problem, like perhaps a calcium absorption problem. And next thing you know, your bones are brittle and it just cascades on and on. So this is the problem. And more specifically, it's uncharted territory. The PDR in 1969 had 1,415 pages. Today, it has 3,536 pages, plus 900 pages of over-the-counter drugs. So there's just more drugs out there. And we lack experience understanding how these drugs all behave together in the, you know, the various cocktails that people are taking.
And part of the problem, too, with some of these cascading prescriptions is that people have multiple doctors. They have specialists, things like that, and they're not communicating with each other, right?
Yeah. Yes, that's one of the problems that we see as primary care providers. My department, which is family medicine and geriatrics, we're primary care providers. So we have patients that go to the cardiologist and go to the endocrinologist for their diabetes and go to the orthopedics doctors for their bone problems, the rheumatologist, sometimes the oncologist, and then they come to us. And maybe they're on 20 drugs, but we have 7 minutes to see them. A normal office visit consists of 7 minutes of contact time with your doctor. So do the math. If you have 20 drugs and you're only seen for 7 minutes, there's really nobody to scrutinize the whole regimen.
So what's the solution to that?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, and I think that Congress and Medicare are starting to understand this. The new Medicare D bill that's been mandated by Congress is the prescription benefit. One thing that they require is that if somebody spends a minimum amount of drug spend, they call it, per quarter, and have a certain criteria of a number of diseases and number of physicians, they have to be seen by a medication management specialist. And that's usually done through the insurance company that's adjudicating the Medicare benefit. What I have done in my clinic, and a lot of people are starting to do who are clinical PharmDs, are providing special medication therapy management appointments. oftentimes when one of my physicians refers a patient to me, they have spent the seven minutes with the patient, but they recognize they can't go through each and every drug. My average visit's about an hour, and right now it's not reimbursed by Medicare because I don't work for the insurance company. But it's interesting in that people are very, very interested in coming to see us for medication management and realizing that the money spent on that saves them a lot of money and maybe hospitalization.
What about you? I mean, you've mentioned Medicare or Medicaid. I'm wondering if insurance companies would jump on board with this as well.
I firmly believe so.
You think they will or you think they should?
I think that Congress made this law because there's plenty of data that cites close medication management saves money. It's something like for every dollar spent, you save $6 if you monitor people's medication use. And one example is private industry. They tend to hire medication management consultants, realizing that it saves mortality, morbidity, and money. So I believe that within 10 years or so, Congress will go ahead and reimburse people in the public who do medication management, whether it be PharmDs or MDs even, or nurses.
So right now, though, it's probably something that you have to take care of on your own if you think you might have a problem with this. How would someone know if they do have a problem with this?
Okay, that's a very good question, and this is why it's so insidious. The hallmark of polypharmacy-induced side effects is nonspecific complaints like a headache, a stomach ache, generalized muscle pain, feeling lightheaded, and oftentimes people write that off as having some sort of a infection or just old age. But oftentimes people don't understand that it's probably the medication they're taking. Another thing that happens is people take a lot of over-the-counter medications that have very serious side effects. And it's totally unrecognized because I think the consumer's been taught by some, you know, advertising that these drugs are targeted, specific, and safe. But the reality is that drugs are targeted, let's say, at a certain, like maybe a stuffy nose, right? But they're really messy. I mean, they go across into your brain, they raise your blood pressure. And so whenever you have a nonspecific symptom and you're taking medications, you have to wonder if it's the medication.
At what number of medications should people start considering that this might be a problem?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. In my book, it's two. I mean, you know, any one or two. I mean, any medication could be toxic, right? Water could be toxic if you drank enough of it. In general, the data seems to show that at five medications taken concurrently, the adverse side effect profile goes up just exponentially. So I'd say five medications if you're chronically ill would be.
Sure. Okay. So then the next step would be, I guess, what should their next step be once they think, I have a few problems, maybe my medications are causing it. Should they go to their doctor or should they find a sort of a medication management specialist?
Absolutely. Notify somebody. Yeah, like I said, I think a lot of people just live with the symptoms, not recognizing that, you know, their headache or their lightheadedness might be their medications. But if you go to your doctor and specifically say, you know, I'm taking all these medications and I'm concerned that these medications are causing me to feel a stomach ache, that will at least flag the physician to actually stop and look. You can also go to your pharmacist. There's a lot of pharmacies that dedicate practitioners to just doing medication management. And, that's a good first step because they're more accessible. The way we use medications today is very much uncharted territory. You have to consider that 40 years ago, we only had a handful of drugs. And today, we have many drugs. Hundreds of drugs come out every year. And each drug is, like I said, targeted at a specific outcome. But the problem is those drugs are not tested with the cocktail of other drugs that the person might be taking. So really it's an experiment when you think about it. And that's why it's difficult to manage.
Yeah. And so it's sort of an emerging field in medicine, basically.
Right. We are now finally realizing, you know, I saw an interesting statistic that in nursing home patients, for every dollar spent on medications, $1.33 is spent on managing the complications of those medications. Of course, that's the most frail of our population, but it goes to show that it's worth consideration. And at the current time, like I said, nobody is reimbursed by Medicare to perform this service, but you can go and get private consultation. So,
and are you starting a private consultation company?
Not company. What happened was in our geriatrics clinic, I recognized that our patients were coming in and only being seen for 7 minutes. So I suggested to the group, why don't I set up office hours? And patients are coming. And oftentimes when I do a public talk, because I do a lot of community talks to try to raise awareness. Golly, one time there was a talk that I gave and there was a line of people an hour long asking their medication questions. And everybody said, how can we see you? How can we get this kind of help? So yes, it's emerging and the need is there. We just need to make it more available, I think, for folks.
So you're finding that as people learn more and more about this, that they are thinking, maybe this actually could be a problem for me and I need to go see somebody about this.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think, I'm thinking of all the drug commercials that I see on TV. Mm-hmm. Do you think because of the way we look at drugs is changing, that is contributing mm-hmm. to this? So in addition to the fact that we have more and more drugs now, but mm-hmm. also that we, from advertising, we have been kind of put in this role of choosing and being more of a consumer of drugs instead of just our doctor just giving us whatever it is that we need. We go to the doctor and say, hey, what about this? What about that? Has that added to this problem in your view?
Very significantly because, I was brought to University of Louisville to work on this polypharmacy initiative, which is part clinical work, but part studying the problem and research. And I have come to the conclusion that it's a little bit like any other public health epidemic, awareness and consumer, the consumer defending themselves is really going to be the answer. Much like smoking or much like drinking, I think for people to blindly have faith that our healthcare system is going to look out for this problem is a pitfall, and that people really do, as consumers, need to be aware that when a drug company tells you that an antipsychotic drug is what you need to get through life, it's not true, because I see in Ladies Home Journal and Oprah Magazine advertisements for antipsychotics. And they show a beautiful young woman with a beautiful family running through a field. And it's subliminally recommending that healthy people take these drugs, when in fact antipsychotics are only used for diagnosed psychosis. But I think what happens is patients then, because of direct-to-consumer marketing, go to their doctor and say, well, like I'd like to try this drug. And what's the quickest way for a doctor to end an office visit? Bring out the prescription pad. So it's an interesting dynamic.
That was Stephanie Sanders talking with Demetra Antimisieris, a U of L professor and pharmacology expert. There's more information at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, more on the recent merger of two Catholic religious orders. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Just over a week ago, a ceremony was held to celebrate the merger of two Catholic religious orders, one in Pennsylvania, the other in Kentucky. That's when the Pittsburgh-based Vincentian Sisters of Charity transferred their vows to become the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth. That order, founded in 1812, is based near Bardstown, Kentucky. I spoke with SCN Vice President Sister Susan Getz about the merger. Tell us how the idea for this merger came about.
Well, in 2002, the Vincentian Sisters of Charity approached us. The Vincentian Sisters of Charity are a small community in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And as they had looked and kind of reflected on their future, they began to see that they were getting smaller. And so they looked to see how could they continue both their community life and their mission and ministries. And one of the things that they felt they needed to do was to look around to see about merging with another group so that they would have more resources and they could kind of continue on and be able to do what they wanted to do in terms of mission. So they approached us, and we began then what became a six-year-long process of looking together, of trying to get to know each other, trying to look to see if these two congregations really would fit together. Was it a good fit for us and for them to come together? One of the things that we had in common is that we are both based in the spirituality of St. Vincent de Paul, so we had that charity roots that we shared. And so that became a really strong foundation for us to begin to think that indeed we could work together, we could be together, and we could be in community together. So then in this past summer, the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth unanimously accepted their proposal that they would merge with us. And they had at their assembly last December in 2007, they had agreed and decided that they would ask us if they could merge. So that was kind of the culmination. Those two decisions were the culmination of that six-year-long process of looking together and praying over it and then finally coming to a decision. It was a very important decision for both congregations, and so we did over the course of those years try to put together a process that was carefully put together, that was prayerful, that gave us ample opportunities to build relationships and to understand each other's communities and history and to appreciate who each community was before we finally said yes, that this is what we would do. But now that we've done it, we really do believe that it will take us into a wonderful future together. It has all kinds of possibilities for us because now we're that much stronger together, and we believe that we will be able to live the mission that we've been given by our founders to really try to live the gospel in this day and time. So.
Now, this had to be, I assume, submitted for church approval from Rome?
Yes, it did. Once we made the decision to merge, when they made the decision and then they sent us the proposal, and then we accepted their proposal, and that was at our General Assembly in Bangalore, India, in June, then we submitted papers to Rome, and it was a relatively simple process, and then Rome sent back to us a decree that said that they had looked over the papers and that they accepted the decision of the two congregations. Then that gave us the go-ahead to really make the plans, and we had determined that November the 15th would be the day that the merger would officially take place. So last weekend, last Saturday, November the 15th, about 90 of the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth from around the U.S. congregation went to Pittsburgh, and all of the Vincentian Sisters of Charity were there, and we celebrated a liturgy together, and for the first time, they made vows as Sisters of Charity of Nazareth. So it was a very touching ceremony for all of us, because with that official merger, their congregation ceased to exist. So that was very touching for us to watch them be willing to let go of their community and become Sisters of Charity of Nazareth for the sake of the mission, because they really believed that this was the best thing for the mission to continue forward. And it really was an international celebration. For one thing, we have wonderful communications people, and they have helped us be able to webcast. And so that ceremony there in the chapel at the Vincentian of the Vincentian Sisters of Charity's mother house was webcast out to our sisters across the world. We have sisters in India and Nepal and Belize and Botswana, and we heard back from them that they were watching, and our sisters here at the mother house, there were about 60 of our sisters who gathered in our mother house chapel here at Nazareth, who also watched on a large screen and were able to participate in that way. And those were older sisters who couldn't travel, but they were really able to be present there. So, and then when we had the dinner following the liturgy, we had letters from and emails from sisters from all across the world, and wishing us all, you know, well, and just kind of reflecting on what this meant for all of us in this international congregation to have this merger happen. So we felt like our sisters from around the world were right there with us, and it was a wonderful celebration of a community really looking to a hopeful future together.
So how will this work? That congregation will now be known as the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth?
Actually, they are Sisters of Charity of Nazareth. All of those sisters now are Sisters of Charity of Nazareth. So there's only one congregation.
I see.
And that's the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth. So what we began to do back once we had made the decision that we would accept their proposal for merger, even before the decree came back from Rome, we began to call them our sisters in Pittsburgh.
I see.
And because their congregation no longer exists.
Now, will they maintain their facilities and property there?
They will have their property there. One of the things that the leadership, the province leadership, is working with them now is their mother house will no longer be a mother house, because the mother house of the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth is here at Nazareth. And so they're looking to rename that building. So that'll be something for them to do, to see what they're going to call what was their mother house. What name will they give that? So
how large of a community do you have now after this?
We have over 700 now, and that's around the world.
Are young women are still coming to join?
They are coming to join. We have several here in the United States. Like many congregations, the growth in our congregation is in India. They still are getting large numbers of young women who come. So I'd say there are probably about 60 young women who are in formation, in all the various stages of formation in India. So there's that's a real hopeful sign for us, too.
Is this unique, or are there other similar things going on with other religious orders?
No, this isn't unique, and it's something that is happening. I'm not sure if it's happening around the world, but certainly in the United States, most of the communities that I know are in some kind of conversation with other congregations. You may have seen that just last week there was an announcement about the Dominican Sisters out here in Springfield. they are joining with seven other congregations, and they're creating a new community. So all of their communities will cease to exist, and they're creating a union, and they renamed it. It's a new community. It's called the Dominicans of Peace. And I know that the Ursulines are also in conversation with other Ursuline communities, and it's the way that congregations right now, because they're getting smaller, are looking to see how can they most effectively continue to carry the mission forward. And so it's asking of us to be open and to be inclusive and to sort of erase the borders and boundaries that maybe we had before for the sake of carrying on a mission into the future. It gives us more people who and more resources to be able to do that. And I think that while it's difficult for all of us to think about that, it also is an exciting time for religious congregations, because we are coming together, you are bonding together with new people, and you're taking all of that ability and talent and commitment and applying it together toward a common mission.
I see. I forgot to ask you, Sister, how many sisters are there in Pittsburgh?
In Pittsburgh, there are about 110.
So this brings the total, as you mentioned, to more than 700 around the world.
More than 700 around the world, yes. And the sisters in Pittsburgh are really excited to be joining and becoming part of an international community. They themselves were pretty much based there in Pittsburgh. They have sisters in different places, you know, in some other states, but they don't have anybody internationally. So to be part of a larger international community brings a lot of life and energy for them too. And I know that there are some of them who are really looking forward, for example, to going to Botswana or Belize or India to visit the sisters there, and some of them probably eventually will look at going there and being in ministry. So that's an exciting thing for them. And one of the reasons that they said that they approached the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth was because we are international, and we have experience in integrating other cultures with the culture of the American community, so that we are growing to be international. And they felt like we would have the experience to be able to integrate their culture into our community as well. So we're working really hard at it, Rick, to make that integration happen, so that they're not just assimilated, but they really are integrated, and the gifts that they have to bring are respected and honored and bring life to the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth. And customs that they have that could enrich us, we're looking, you know, how do we incorporate those and integrate those into our life, so that really it is a new community, and not just, okay, well, you just come and be part of us and you do everything the way we do it. No, it's trying to see how do we do things together in the future in new ways.
That was Sister Susan Getz, Vice President of the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth, talking about the Kentucky-based order's recent merger with the Vincentian Sisters of Pittsburgh. More information about the nuns and their work is available at our website, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at wfpl.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio. collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.